planting, for outdoor recreation, in a way so that we can generate revenue not only for landowners, but also for entire communities. So that's the solution. The solution should not be a market-based solution, but it should be a solution that is for people and for the planet.
Dana Smith and Leo Woodbury, thanks so much for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Wes Montgomery and the Dramatics. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bag and Baggage Productions presents The Tempest, performing from Thursday, August 11th through Sunday, August 28th in Hillsboro. This bilingual adaptation of William Shakespeare's The Tempest will be performed throughout various parks in Hillsboro. The Tempest is a story of love, redemption, forgiveness, and the nature of storytelling. That's Bag and Baggage Production presents The Tempest, performing from Thursday, August 11th through Sunday, August 28th in Hillsboro. More information can be found at kb.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Every single person since SB8 has been a law has needed to travel out of state. Every single person that's reached our line.
We've been clinging on to Roe versus Wade and the protection that it offered. And it feels as though that protection is being taken away from us. So it feels as though this is a moment of survival. And I think any moments of survival can be very scary.
What did abortion access look like in America when Roe was the law of the land? Tune into KBOO's Roe on the Rocks, a limited series podcast where I investigate this question as I take you through the months leading up to the U.S. Supreme Court decision that effectively overturned Roe. That's Roe on the Rocks, airing Thursdays at 9 a.m. You don't want to miss it.
I'm Dr. Mike Shapiro, and you're listening to Radio Awakened, produced at KRBX in Boise, Idaho. The show that deep dives into the process of becoming the best of ourselves. And today is about living in a mindful universe. In the various practices I engage in, from music and dance to meditation, contemplative prayer, plant medicine, and trance dance, I have found the universe to be conscious, not only of me, but of itself. The conscious or mindful universe, as my guests call it, seemed to gather information about itself through our own experiences and perceptions. The universe seems to learn about itself through us. World-renowned musicians report feeling as if the universe was playing through them while they're engaged effortlessly in the creative process. Extreme endurance athletes in flow report the feelings of their bodies moving effortlessly in ways most of us would find excruciatingly painful and intolerable. Not only do we have access to the unlimited creative energy and potential of the universe, we in fact are the universe unfolding. What all mystical spiritual traditions hold true is that we are unique manifestations of a unitive, underlying, all-present, formless source that exists in terms of possibilities. It takes us waking up to truly know and embody this, not theoretically, but in our own bodies and perceptions, and then skills to refine and sustain these new changes. And this is where we begin our journey today, talking with Eben Alexander and Karen Newell, whose book, Living in a Mindful Universe, encourages us to walk the spiritual path to awaken the heart of the mindful universe that lies deep within each one of us. Eben Alexander was an academic neurosurgeon for 25 years, including 15 years at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, Children's Hospital, and Harvard Medical School in Boston. A pioneering scientist and modern thought leader with a passionate interest in physics and cosmology, he is the author of New York Times' number one best-selling Proof of Heaven, The Map of Heaven, and Living in a Mindful Universe. Karen Newell is an author and specialist in personal development with a diverse body of work that rests upon the foundation of heart-centered consciousness. As an innovator in the emerging field of brainwave entertainment audio meditation, Karen empowers others in their journey of self-discovery by demonstrating how to connect to inner guidance, achieve inspiration, improve wellness, and develop intuition. She is the founder of Sacred Acoustics and co-author of Living in a Mindful Universe. So I want to welcome both of you to the show. Thank you so much for being with me.
Hi, thanks for having us on. It's great to be here.
Yes, thank you so much.
You're welcome. I'm really excited to talk to you both about your perspective on what it means to live in a mindful universe. And I want to start at the end. What's your message to all of us?
Well, I think the most important thing is to realize we are not our little ego mind, that voice, the little running stream of thoughts in our head. So many of us identify with that as who we are. And I would like for people to remember, I love the way Michael Singer puts it in his book, The Untethered Soul. He calls that voice in our heads the annoying roommate. And that's a beautiful way to put it, because what I found, especially since my own coma experience and the 12 years since and trying to make sense of it all, is that having an expanded view of self that rises way above my little ego mind is an especially important kind of way of seeing things that rings true, makes a lot more sense than the old version I had of this little ego mind struggling its way through life. So if we can start to see ourselves as much bigger, more interconnected beings, I think that's an important lesson of this awakening.
Yes, and I would just add that when we think about who we are as individuals, we often think about, you know, the roles we play, the children we have, the job we have, but in reality, we're all fundamentally spiritual beings. And being in the body for this temporary time we call life is an opportunity that Michael, you explained so beautifully, that we don't learn through positive experiences mm-hmm. as much as we learn through those very challenging experiences. Mm-hmm. And so it's an extremely important thing to realize that as we go through these challenges, we're actually growing spiritually. Our essence is what is learning from this, not the fact that we're a mother or a teacher, but our essence of who we are, that divine spark, and that all those mystical traditions that you mentioned agree with, that we all come out of this whole. And the scientific community, which really is the secular community that runs our world, has kind of stripped this concept out of our very beingness. And right. So remembering that there's a spiritual aspect to us, whether you're religious or spiritual or not, it's just a fact of life. And the more of us who start to realize this, the more we can really make effective change in our world.
I want to ask both of you the same question then. because we're talking about waking up to something beyond what we perceive as fundamental, as this ego self, this stream of the stream of consciousness in our head that sounds like us, so it's really easy to believe. I'm like, I'm just saying something in my own voice, it must be true. So then how do we wake up knowing there's something larger than that stream or that voice that we're hearing?
Well, I think one thing is being aware of these kind of experiences. Ken Ring, who is one of the founders of the International Association of Near-Death Studies, wrote long ago about some academic papers, studies of the effect of knowing of NDEs in the population at large. And what he demonstrated was just being aware of these kind of experiences is sufficient to expand many people's kind of notion of self and kind of their daily life experience, to realize the power of things like meditation and centering prayer, that connecting with that kind of mental realm within, especially when you realize the modern scientific view is that the brain is not a creator of consciousness, but a filter that allows in primordial consciousness. Then you realize that exploring in your consciousness is a way of getting out into the universe beyond the veiling function of the brain, the kind of filtering mechanism of brain and body. So it's knowing of this and then starting to adventure ourselves in prayer and meditation and various ways of going within, I think is a very powerful tool.
Yes, and one of the really important things to do when you enter into one of these practices is to really recognize that observer behind the thoughts. And so by observer, I just mean it's a different part of you. And you can recognize it most easily, say, when you're trying to do a very basic meditative technique of just staying calm, watching your breath. And this is supposed to, you know, make your mind go blank. At least that's what I thought when I learned about meditation. But what I realized was that my thoughts could still be going on, but it's when I noticed that my mind had wandered. Mm-hmm. That noticing part is very important to start to recognize and understand, because that's the part of you that's behind all of this ego mind. And the more you can try to identify with that, the more you're getting closer to that spiritual aspect of yourself.
Mm. I appreciate that, because we want to make this really practical for our listeners. You know, I want both a sense of awe and wonder about the experiences you've had, the near-death experience, opening up this beautiful vista of the universe that doesn't seem accessible to us when we're kind of in our living trance life of working and just doing the rote things we think are necessary. But I also want it to be very practical, so that people listening go, well, how do I get a taste or touch of this majesty, what I call the majesty of the mystery? And so if we can speak on both of those levels, both the majesty of the mystery, but also how do we do this practically? Because we do work, we're parents, we have dogs, we have, you know, we have jobs, we have a regular normal life, but what I want to do is bring the mystical into the ordinary. And that's what I'm hoping most for people.
Well, one of the ways that's really easy to do that, easy way to think about it, is so many of us will have creative inspiration, whether it's trying to solve a problem or even just plan a vacation, or you're a painter or a writer. And when you access that creative zone, I'll say, you're really moving beyond this physical world and what we've been talking about, the everyday, and you're accessing something that's beyond. And many of us just take that for granted. And as you said, you know, musicians feel like, you know, the music is going through them, that they're not doing it, someone else is. And we can all access this every day, but we don't think about it that way. So it comes through as intuitive knowings that so many of us just dismiss as, oh, that was just a coincidence or something. But really learning to honor that inner intuition, that connection to creativity, is a really beautiful way to sort of ground these ideas.
I would simply add that, you know, before my coma, I recognized that we use our linguistic brain, that kind of voice of rational thought, logic, and all in our head. And we use that and try and work our way to follow breadcrumbs to certain conclusions and understandings about the nature of the universe. But that is not the only way we can come into knowing. And for example, Albert Einstein used to float around in a sailboat, gazing up at the sky, daydreaming for hours on end until these kind of visions that helped him put together his models of the universe would come into his awareness. He was not necessarily just following that rational, logical voice in his head to get there. Likewise, Robert Louis Stevenson had some techniques of getting into a hypnagogic space. Mm-hmm. And he used that as the seed for a lot of his works in novels and music and poetry. Salvador Dali, similar thing. Thomas Alva Edison, one of the greatest inventors in our American history, used to use that hypnagogic space. He would put weights in his hands, and when he was really tired, as they would drop off and drop off, he'd do about two or three micro naps, and that little engagement with the hypnagogic space, and he would open his mind to just receive from the universe.
Yeah.
And I think what Karen and I often teach in our workshops is for people to learn to state an intention, make a request at the beginning of a meditation, but then put your little linguistic brain into timeout.
Mm-hmm.
Just let the universe offer you what it's going to give you. And I think that's a very important lesson, that in creativity, a lot of this can come if we simply set the stage in our kind of mental space to allow the universe to gift us with these kind of nuggets, gems of knowledge.
That's so beautiful. Well said. Thank you. And really about waking up to the beauty of the mystery and how to bring that into your everyday waking life. And right now we're talking about the creative process, that one of the ways in which we can touch the mystery, the beauty of the universe, is by engaging in a creative process that seems to take some of our linguistic or ego-centered kind of thinking process while using it, put it off to the side. But what that means to me is engaging the heart, engaging the body, really being present with the felt sense of being alive and letting the paintbrush and our heart work together. How do you suggest we do that while we're making dinner, while we're working? Is there a way to bring the beauty of what you've both felt and touched into ordinary waking life?
Well, I think one thing that I've noticed is by meditating an hour or two a day, and I've been doing that for more than a decade now, there's kind of a natural shift in your mental function and your kind of connection with the universe. And you start noticing with that regular practice, one of the consequences is a more natural kind of gnosis in your dealings with others and dealing with the universe. I think the very practice of doing this in meditation, of trying to connect with that kind of higher ordering of the universe on a regular basis, enables us to connect in that way, even when we're not meditating.
Mm-hmm.
Very powerful. And I would simply add, hearing you talk about this, I've known many musicians and athletes who realized that when they tried to think, mm-hmm. in what they were doing, like trying to hit a baseball or what have you, or whatever that musical piece is you're trying to achieve, and they realize all that thinking actually got in the way. So there's a way of kind of getting down into a flow state, a more natural kind of resonance with the universe, where we're not so much using that conscious mind to think to make the things happen, especially with performance like in music or athletics. But in many ways, we just become more one with the universe. That's a lot of what we're talking about with this living in a mindful universe, is learning to receive and allow that energy to flow through us.
And one thing I would add, you know, you said, well, how do you do this while you're cooking dinner or something, you know, going through your daily life? And one exercise that I have worked into my daily life, really every moment of the, of my life, is to imagine that my breathing is actually moving in and out of my heart rather than my nose and mouth. So I imagine, I just have this feeling it's coming in and out of my heart. And as it's doing that, it's filling up this bubble or sphere surrounding my body. So I breathe out into the bubble and then I breathe back into my heart. And just kind of doing this on a, not a very hugely conscious level, but sort of an automated, I just imagine that's how my breath is going all the time. I seem to be more connected to the universe, especially when I'm with other people, because we know from heart math that the heart's electromagnetic field is expanding and contracting around your body. It's interacting with other hearts around you, collecting information, bringing it back in, radiating information back out. So when you have this conscious awareness that this is going on, and I use it through the mechanism of my breath, mm-hmm. you start to feel that visceral connection between other people without even having to say a word. So that's mm-hmm. a fun thing to do while you're standing in a line, even if you are having a heated conversation with someone, start mm-hmm. to enact that breathing and see how it might change, you know, what's mm-hmm. going on around you. It's really interesting to do that.
Mm. That's a good practice. And it brings up to mind the biofield. So I have Dr. Chamani Jain, the director of Consciousness and Healing Initiative. I had her on the show and we talked about biofield science, that which connects us. And so you were talking about heart math science also, the synchrony of hearts and heart rate variability between people who are bonded, or as Dan Siegel might say, attuned, and their mirror neurons are firing. And so, I mean, this, we're really talking about that which is in us that connects to everything around us, people, animals, plants, the universe itself. And when we become attuned to ourself, within ourself, we start attuning to everything around us. And this makes for a world that I would imagine has more peace, more equanimity, more harmony, and less divisiveness, less division. So part of my hope of this show is that we talk about ways in which we become better human beings, not just, you know, for ourselves, but for the whole community and the planet. I wanted to know if you had any thoughts on that expansion of your work. Yeah.
Well, I would just add, in relation to the heart anyway, when you are paying attention to your own heart, you create beneficial feelings, clear out emotional trauma. As you're working on yourself, because your heart naturally radiates and influences people around you, while you're working on yourself, you're actually serving others. Yeah. And so I like to think that any personal development that I do, it's not really a selfish act, but as I become more, I'll just say, healthy in the mm-hmm. whole, the whole benefits from that. And so anytime anyone makes an effort, even just to quiet their mind or reduce their anxiety, I'm so grateful, because they are part of all of us. And so we really all need to realize we're in it together for real.
And I would simply add that a huge part of what we're trying to argue in our book, Living in a Mindful Universe, and I know other scientists studying consciousness have come out with similar books in the last few years. So we're all really kind of headed in a same direction. But the important point about it is to note that modern science has come to realize the profound fundamental existence of consciousness, that it seems mm-hmm. to be an ontological primitive, that is, mm-hmm. the constituent of the universe that then generates everything else. Yeah. And so, you know, many the scientists involved in consciousness studies, most of them have come to realize materialism fails. You know, the notion that the brain creates consciousness is ridiculous. Nobody's ever been able to come up with a way to make that work at all. And yet there are many kind of dualisms, philosophies that involve a certain relationship between brain and the physical world and mind and consciousness. For example, panpsychism is one of the emerging models that I do not believe is true. That's simply adding proto-consciousness to every little subatomic particle, and then kind of in a materialist fashion, assuming that as you mm-hmm. assemble them, you end up with some form of consciousness. But right. that really misses the bigger point mm-hmm. of the one mind that we're all really sharing. And it's not just humans, it's all of life throughout the universe sharing this one mind, and we exist in that one mind. But the good news is, as sentient beings, we can interact with that mental layer of the universe that's really the origin of that mind. Mm-hmm. And that's where we can have so much influence on our lives that rises above the simplistic expectations of materialism. And that, for example, is why placebo effect works, that mm-hmm. mind over matter has a very dramatic role in our healing of self. And this is only because there truly is a top-down, mentally derived ordering force in the universe.
I wanted to ask you, I'm specifically not asking a lot about your near-death experience, because you have a book that people can read. And also I wanted to just give us a chance to talk about right now what's happening in your work and what you're hoping to awaken in people. I did want to ask, Evan, though, did your near-death experience change the way you relate to people? Really, what I want to know, did it make you a better person?
I think it did. I mean, I could tell you my my older son, Evan the Fourth, he gave me a big hug 2 days after I got out of the hospital back in 2008. He had driven overnight to surprise me the day before Thanksgiving. And I told him it was way too real to be real. And he told me later that he felt when we had that hug, he felt like there was a light shining within me, that I was far more present than I'd ever been before. And I know when I did visit Bruce Grayson and the group at UVA to tell my story 2 years after my NDE, when they invited me to come up and do that, and Evan went with me, my oldest son. And when Bruce Grayson asked him, you know, what do you make of all this with your father? He said, well, this is not the man who raised me.
Yes.
So obviously, I had gone through a very big change. And if that involved being more present than I'd been before, well, I'm sorry what that says about me as a father before, but I promise you, it was a much more engaged kind of presence of mind and of soul that harps on and dwells on the reality of our soul connections with fellow souls, all in this beautiful mission of trying to wake this world up. So I don't have any doubt that I went through an extraordinary transformation, but for me, it's all been a tremendous blessing.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Karen, did you have any thought? I don't know. I don't think you knew Evan before his coma.
No, I did not know Evan before his coma, so I cannot speak to how he was different. Right. But I can tell you how he's kind of evolved over time. And when I first met Evan, that was 3 years.
3 years after.
3 years after coma. He was very intense. His energy was just so palpable. And he's much more grounded now. But he's not. He hasn't. You said something about how some people go back into their slumber. He has absolutely not done that. He's more grounded these concepts and learnings that he had into his daily interactions. So it's very good.
You can't go back to slumber after a wake-up call like that.
No, you can't. And I tell my patients, are you sure you want to start this process? You can't unsee what you see.
Right.
You can't go back to who you were. There's no road back that way. You won't consciously choose that anymore, but it's you will struggle to move forward, letting go of all the things you thought were true to you.
Well, and another benefit I have is I learned on my NDE, and it's only been strengthened in the ensuing 12 years, I can trust in this universe. The universe has our back. There is a tremendous amount of love that all of us can harvest from gaining a richer, more facile, and more kind of awake and knowing relationship with those fundamental forces in the universe. So and it's really a gift.
And you don't need to have a near-death experience. Thinking, oh, I can only learn this. How can I have one of those? Absolutely not. I have learned all of these things that Evan speaks of. Before I even met him, I understood these things just from my own personal experience and practices, much as you've explained, Michael, because you rattled off all kinds of techniques. I have tried many, many techniques as well. And all of us, when we try these techniques, we find what works best for us. We're all going to be a little unique. Some of us like the mantras, some of us like the movement. It's just takes some trial and error, but all of us can reach into that energy. It's really our birthright to understand that we are part of this, not only bigger, larger energy of oneness, but as Evan said, underneath all of that is this loving, beneficial kind of energy that's there for all of us.
When I found this real living connection to the universe through my practices, I couldn't help but take care of everything, plants and animals, the way my diet changed, the way I talked to people, the way I cared for insects, all changed because there's an interrelatedness and interconnectedness that's undeniable. And knowing this, how can we not take care of humans, plants, animals, the planet, the cosmos? Because all of our well-being is dependent on all of our well-being, everything. So I just know if there's a concluding statement you may each have about the power of waking up to living in a mindful universe.
I would say for me, probably most important, is to point out that I would say that most of the major problems we have in our world today in terms of conflict, economic polarization, warfare, violence against others, certainly the cataclysm in our climate, et cetera, every bit of it, it really has its roots in a false sense of separation, that we believe we're separate beings. And that's really at the heart of reductive materialist science, is everything separate, trying to understand how they interrelate. But the new quantum informed version of science, especially in looking at consciousness and all that, fully reflects the power of our need for stewardship, to take responsibility for our choices. And it's always about the higher good, not this kind of selfish focus on our personal good, but really the higher good. And that's where we can really liberate our souls and selves, is by serving as a conduit for that energy to help this world, help every one of our fellow beings.
And I would just add that this illusion of separation, this idea that we're just mechanical beings stumbling our way through a chaotic universe that is rampant in our secular world, it's really misinformed. Not only is modern quantum science figuring all of this out, this idea that we're all connected, but our mystical traditions going back thousands of years have already known this. Mm. And deep down, most humans already know this at a fundamental level. And it's our logical mind that tries to tell us that it's not real just because of our conditioning. But we do, and we can cultivate this bigger connection. And doing so brings much, much more meaning and purpose to our very existence. Mm. This existential crisis of why are we here and what is our purpose, that can be answered by understanding that we're part of one whole, and that we're evolving together for, you know, to really understand this love that connects us all. So that's what I would leave your listeners with.
Well, great, great, beautiful sentiments. Very powerful to sit with both of you. Well, folks, that's our show today. I definitely want to thank Eben Alexander and Karen Newell for being on here with me. Just think about all of this stuff for a moment. How do you want to wake up? What would help you wake up and live your fullest life? Music is Lucky 13 by Jeff Coffin and the Mutet. So just a reminder, this is your life to live. So dare to dream and live big and become who you're meant to be. Produced at KRBX in Boise, Idaho. This is Radio Awakened. I'm Dr. Mike Shapiro.
Miss, I'm ready for the road. Put me on the radio, I'm ready for the road. We no come for players, I'm a touch a stage show. Fire does a blaze, so them never they know. KBOO run the place, no, yeah. Yeah, man, I'ma say this is the KBOO Full Strength Community Radio. And you know it's Kabaka Pyramid representing and Full Dawson. Baby Rock family, you don't know Kingston, Jamaica, we say. Yeah, Portland, no.
From KRBX in Boise, Idaho, welcome to Radio Awakened, exploring the furthest reaches of human potential, the show that deep dives into the process of becoming the best of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Shapiro. Today's show is on connecting across differences with Angela Okawa. As this show is reaching its end, I feel a sense of pressure to share what I consider to be such important topics to help our human community to be better to one another. Having grown up as a third-generation Holocaust survivor and seeing firsthand the impact of violence and hatred done toward my family for practicing a certain religion and having specific facial and bodily features, I have dedicated my life to collective healing and transformation. Sorry to be so blunt, but humans can be and are often terrible to one another, and that's generally based out of fear, ignorance, greed, and hatred. I've spent so much of my adult life bringing attention to the collective harmful psychological impacts of racism, sexism, homophobia, xenophobia, and any other oppressive way of being that marginalizes and disempowers a group of people based on seeming differences from the dominant group. What I find overall is that most people I engage with on these topics don't want others to be hurt, but often feel helpless to make a difference or don't own their parts in the process. They also feel overwhelmed and uncomfortable just talking about these topics, which makes it very difficult to work toward collective change when we struggle to even engage in conversations. What I have personally found to be the most powerful tool in affecting change in my community is deep listening. Listening with an open heart, curiosity, and compassion when people who are different from me share their experiences. Listening is a sacred act, one that connects people heart to heart, and where new perspectives can be heard, reflected on, and ultimately shared for everyone's benefit. Today, I've invited someone whose work in the field I respect. Angela works with individuals and organizations committed to building capacity to be with difference and practicing deep belonging. With a background in tech startups and design thinking, as well as experience working with trauma, culture, and identity, Angela brings us a unique perspective to working with difference. She is a certified integral coach and licensed marriage and family therapist. Angela, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. So happy to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you. Maybe we can start with you sharing with our listeners who you are and what brought you to the work.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for the introduction. I got just kind of hearing myself kind of fed back to me. I think just hearing your story really moved me, just because it so much resonates with my own story, mm-hmm. obviously different components, mm-hmm. but that having grown up biracial and bicultural, spending time in Japan and moving between there and the US, I experienced a lot of just a lot of difference, a lot of being different here, seen by my classmates as strange, with strange mm-hmm. food and strange mannerisms, and then going to Japan and spending summers there with my Japanese family and being also very strange there as mm. well, not really belonging. Mm. And I got really good at figuring out how to bridge those two worlds, painfully at first mm. because of just not belonging, but then learning to find ways to kind of help people see from the inside the other side. Mm. I found like people just had an idea of Japan and they weren't really seeing the ways that Japanese are just, you know, think of the world so differently. Mm-hmm. And that's carried a bit into my other work. I mean, I've worked mm-hmm. in tech and then I worked as a psychotherapist, two very different mm-hmm. environments. And I feel like I'm bridging those constantly in my work with people mm-hmm. where my therapy skills are very helpful when working with, you know, mm-hmm. DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion work mm-hmm. with folks. So well, yeah, mm-hmm. go ahead.
Well, many people have these experiences, but don't make a career out of it, don't dedicate their life to this. What about these topics? Or is that
some people grow up with it I really wonder. I mean, with my life, I feel like I was always helping people that were different. Mm. Like maybe I feel like it was because of my own moving back and forth and maybe mm. my personality, but mm. I was always that person to kind of see the person that's not feeling like that they were just the other, the different mm. culture, different race, whatever it was. I was always the one to talk to them and help them kind mm. of bring them in as a young kid. I used to do that. And then as I got older, I just had this knack for just really getting into other people's world and then seeing mm. it from their perspective. And then almost like feeling into it with them and mm-hmm. then seeing the ways in which the world I was coming from was oppressive or the ways mm-hmm. in which my way of being actually wasn't helping the situation. Mm-hmm. Like I could pop out and see myself from the outside. And that skill, I saw it just so needed in all the spaces mm-hmm. that I've been in. I just felt like a calling to do that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really have a choice. So it's mm-hmm. with this work, it doesn't feel like a choice. It just feels like this is what I'm to do.
Yeah, I understand. In Buddhism, we call that our dharma in some way, what we're born to do. Whether we want to or not, we always come back to it.
Exactly. I'm an introvert. Like, this is not my spaces that I typically would seek out. And yet I find myself in group spaces facilitating conversations around difference. And I love it when I'm in it. And it feels like something that's just what I do. And yet if you told me this 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I'd be like, no, I'm not going to do that.
Well, let's talk about the work a little bit. I'd like to hear, you know, what are you actually doing? Are you working with groups of people who are different? Mm-hmm. Are you in organizations? And what are you doing?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. I've worked, so some of the companies and organizations that I work with, they seek me out when they can feel that there's a cultural divide between parts of, you know, the people within the company. And one company stands out, was a French company and an American company, and fairly international, but, you know, kind of very much those two. And they were having a hard time with working with some of the Asian people within the organization. They wanted to bring me in and help, like, how do we communicate with each other? And so I just introduced some simple things around just communication styles, which were really new to them, that there's these indirect ways of communicating that some countries, like Asian countries, typically use. And then there's very direct ways, which like German, Russian, like US, like there's, we can be a bit more direct here, and that's seen as good, right? Indirect seen as bad here. Whereas you go to Asia, it's the opposite. Right? You want to be so direct. And so when I brought that up into the company, I got a email from a concerned person from the French side of the company, just saying that they felt like I was offending the Asian culture by calling them indirect, because that was offensive. And so there's ways in which just bridging that of like, oh, you're coming from a different lens. And so you're seeing this as bad. So that's kind of how I come in and help people see something as so simple as that.
How do you, I mean, that takes a lot of nuances and subtlety and also a lot of information of all these various cultures to do what you're doing. So are you, do you study this? Is it part of what you're doing?
Right. Well, there's a great book called The Culture Map. And I recommend it to anyone that, you know, deals internationally with different cultures. And they have kind of set maps around ways of relating with each other around communication, ways of coming to consensus, ways of, you know, giving feedback. You know, it's just these great shorthands that I find. And I apply it just even into like relationships, because I do relationship coaching and therapy, working with individuals that way too. And you work, like, people who are in like an intercultural or interracial relationship, there's, you know, big differences of just how people show affection or show love or communicate, even within relationships, that the signals just get completely missed, right? One person thinks they're being clear and the other ones, you know, can't hear them.
Totally. Yeah. That can happen even within the same kind of culture. People are raised so differently that their communication styles don't work at all. Just because our show is so short and this is such an important topic, I'd like to drop into talking maybe first about, I guess the heart of my wondering is why do people struggle so much with differences? And that, because it creates there's such violence in the world based on these differences. And so in order, before we get to like how you do your work, I'd like to drop into why do you have to do your work in the first place?
Yeah, well, I think you're pointing to a particular type of difference, right? You said in your introduction, just talking about your own cultural background and, right, anti-Semitism and just like how hate, like difference can turn into like hating the other. The way I feel into it, though, if I'm thinking of just the average person, sometimes it's hard to think of a whole group of people, right? We get a little outside of ourselves. But when I meet people who are struggling to understand someone, it's that, it's like they're coming from a different value place. They're interpreting a certain person's behavior as, you know, nonsensical or just wrong. Sort of like that person who was concerned I was insulting the Japanese by calling them indirect, right? But I wasn't. I was just pointing out that that's a different way of communicating. Sometimes those things can come up where people see a different culture in that way of just something wrong. But then there's also historical context of certain understanding of history, a certain or lack of empathy, maybe of really fully feeling into the horrors that have happened. And but yeah, I think it's just ultimately it's like a deep, it's a fear. People are scared of things that are different.
Yeah.
And if you're not exposed to a lot of difference in your life, it can seem threatening to your way of life, your way of living.
Right.
And people can feel like a great sense of anxiety. And there's actually studies done on this that it's like an existential anxiety or threat, mm-hmm. like there something bad is going to happen. And
yes, right.
they start seeing the other as the cause of that badness, being, you know, people at the border or whatever it is. It's this like existential threat that's just coming in to hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
But really, you know, it's just, I think a lot of people just not comfortable with change.
Yeah, yeah. I read a book by Sebastian Younger, I think his name was, who
yeah. Tribe.
High Tribe, yeah. And it's so fascinating. You know, when we have a threat to our community, we gather against that threat. And if we have a threat against our country, we gather mm-hmm. and we all unite.
Yeah.
And if we have a world threat, then we gather and unite. And mm-hmm. but as soon as that threat's over, we go back to hating one another, just as we did before the threat.
Yeah.
It's like we dissolve back into, wait, you're different, even though we were just fighting aliens.
Right.
Now you're from this other place that I remember I don't like.
Right. And
I'm so sad that that's what we do as human beings.
Yeah, but I can also too... there's a part of me that tried to empathize. Like if you lived in a small town and everything stayed the same for, you know, generations, you know, you had your church that you went to, this mm-hmm. this family did that, and you know, and then all of a sudden immigrants start coming in, they want different food, mm-hmm. you know, restaurants are changing, like, and it's just changing too fast for some people. Mm-hmm. Like I could see how, you know, that could be uncomfortable and scary. Mm-hmm. Like our way of life is now being taken over by some other people, and we need mm-hmm. to fight for it. We need to keep mm-hmm. our way of life. Part of me can get that. I can understand mm-hmm. that. And so working with people with that anxiety, not trying to, you know, increase it, but just, you know, mm-hmm. helping them like calm their nervous system. I think that's mm-hmm. such a big piece of this work is mm-hmm. like our nervous systems are just in a heightened state of anxiety and threat. Mm-hmm.
This is a good place to just let you all know we're talking with Angela Okawa, who's a therapist and consultant helping companies and individuals work across differences. You're listening to Radio Awakened. And right now we're just talking about what happens when we meet difference. Our nervous system starts getting a little agitated or defensive and we start seeing threats. So can you speak a little bit more of that? Mm-hmm. And then maybe we'll go into what do you do to help restore that so we can talk across differences.
Yeah, I mean, what's so fascinating just about our nervous system is there's a great book by, I think it's Robert Sapolsky. Yeah. I don't know if I'm saying mm-hmm. his name right, Behave, that talks about just slowly, second by second, millisecond by millisecond, how when we engage someone who's different from us, like facial features, mm-hmm. Skin color, how our amygdala fires, whether mm-hmm. we want it to or not. And that sends a moment of just like a fear within us that there could be a threat. But then with enough time, you know, our other more slower parts of our brain, like the human parts of our brain, can go, oh, wait, actually, you're not under threat. Mm-hmm. We're fine. Mm-hmm. Everything's good. But if we're constantly in a state of, you know, anxiety, especially with COVID too, mm-hmm. like we're heightened to pick up the threat. So that is just, we're primed for it. And I think just some people are in a heightened state more often than not. I mean, you mentioned, you know, your background with Buddhism, just mm-hmm. studies showing that regular meditation can actually shrink the size. I would love mm-hmm. to double check on this, but I think this is mm-hmm. true. Shrinks the size of the amygdala.
It does, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so there's ways that the people just have higher reactivity because of trauma. That could mm-hmm. be something that's there. You know, so some people are just ready to jump to that mm-hmm. heightened space mm-hmm. or state much quicker than others.
So great. So we're seeing people who are different. It's yep. the food smell different. They look yep. different. We mm-hmm. might have a sense of threat. Mm-hmm. And some of it's just built in for survival. Some of it's conditioned, like racism yep. that's embedded in our systems. We're mm-hmm. taught certain things. So we just go, oh, I should move across the street here. I should mm-hmm. hold my purse, even though there mm-hmm. might, I mean,
yeah.
Right. So yeah. there's taught, conditioned, and then there's just natural threat response. What right. do you do with people and individuals, and how do you teach even organizations to be aware of this so that they can start working across differences?
Right. Well, I think just with the people I work with, a lot of them are pretty much like on board with like I'm not biased. Like I've mm-hmm. done a lot of work, you know, that most of them is about getting them to acknowledge that they do have these biases, mm-hmm. that they mm-hmm. do have this, they have been socialized, yeah. whether they want mm-hmm. to believe it or not, it's mm-hmm. in there. And for them to actually catch them, because it's very unconscious. Mm-hmm. So off, it's not usually visible. So mm-hmm. that's part of the work, is getting them to start noticing that that's there and like mm-hmm. admit it, and then let's go, you know, kind of work from there. And so once they start to notice it, then they start to go, oh, I'm actually uncomfortable with, you know, someone of say a different race, and they realize they're actually uncomfortable with it, with them. Or maybe someone who's transgender, like, I don't mm-hmm. know what to say. I mess up with mm-hmm. the pronouns. Like I just, and so I work with them with their nervous systems of just, okay, you're going to mess up, especially say with pronouns. This is new for you. You never have done this before. So just give them things like just practice seeing their face, saying the pronoun, mm-hmm. you know, on the side, and just kind of work through it and know that if you mess up, it's okay. Just, you know, correct yourself and move on. And so mm-hmm. oftentimes it's just working with their nervous system and just, mm-hmm. you know, letting them know you're going to mess up. Let's just move mm-hmm. through it. It's okay. Mm-hmm.
I love that. Yeah. One of my favorite parts of this work, and it wasn't in the beginning, but it is now, is becoming radically honest about who I am and my biases mm-hmm. and my belief systems, because I used to be so defensive. I'm in the social justice field. Right. I care about everybody equally. And I'd make all these missteps and I'd hurt people, not on purpose, but I would hear, oh, I'm impacting people. And I'd be like, well, no, I didn't mean it. And here, mm-hmm. da, da, da. Now I'm like, oh, tell me more. What happened? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, yeah. And now mm-hmm. I can reflect and go, you know what? I'm a little uncomfortable with this or you yeah. or this topic. And it's actually really freeing. I want yeah. the audience to know it's so liberating to speak the truth, yeah. even if it's uncomfortable, that you can actually do the work from a place of ease and care yeah. rather than defensiveness.
Yeah, I mean, just even hearing you say that, my whole nervous system kind of mm-hmm. calmed down a little, you know, just kind of relaxed mm-hmm. a little bit. Because I can imagine if I were to tell you something, like I'm seeing this thing, a bias mm-hmm. in you. And if you said back to me like, oh, I'm really uncomfortable, I think that's why I said that, or, but I want to hear more, tell me more. Mm-hmm. It's so congruent with what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. Rather than if someone said, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't mean any harm, but mm-hmm. what I said was fine. Then there's this incongruence where I'm like, something happened, but you're behaving differently.
Right.
But you're being so congruent with what's happening that I can relax around it, even mm-hmm. though you're uncomfortable, but you named it. And then it's like, oh, okay, I can work with that.
Totally. Yeah. Then we can work with each other because yeah. you're not sensing being defensive is actually putting up a wall between us.
Yeah.
And now I got to say, I still get defensive.
Sure.
I can feel my body tense up and I can actually hear and feel my mind wanting to argue the point.
Yeah.
But I've now training myself to go, hold on, Mike. I listen, just listen, listen for a mm-hmm. second. Just yeah. listen. Maybe yeah. it's true, maybe it's not, but I won't know until I really hear a person out and learn something. So, yeah, I'd like
to. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, go ahead. Sorry.
No,
yeah, I was just thinking, like, that's such a great thing that most people don't think about, is that it's so vulnerable. I think people feel exposed that by saying, I don't know what to do here, like, mm-hmm. as they're talking. Something happened, like they don't understand why someone's so mad at them, just saying, I really don't know what's happening, but I really mm-hmm. want to understand. Please, if you don't mind, could you tell me a little bit more of your experience mm-hmm. to help me better mm-hmm. understand, right? Mm-hmm. And just really be honest in that
yes,
space is
totally.
The opposite of what people think. They think they're supposed to know. They think, oh, I'm mm-hmm. supposed to know what I'm doing and say the right things.
Right.
But really, you don't need to say all the right things. Just mm-hmm. be true to what you're actually mm-hmm. feeling.
That's such good permission, because so many of us are wounded from parents who have high expectations or put yeah. so much on us to be right all the time. I'm speaking about myself.
Sure.
And so then if I mess up, it immediately elicits the, oh crap, I'm bad. I should yeah. be ashamed. And now I have to defend myself.
Now you're all spiraling into like a shame spiral, and then you're dysregulated and
yeah.
not thinking straight. So it makes things a lot worse. Yeah.
A lot harder to connect to another
Absolutely.
Person. Also just sitting there wounded and waiting to be heard. That's it.
Yeah.
We're talking with Angela Okawa about connecting across differences. And I know before the show began, you asked if there's time, if we can do maybe an exercise together. So I think this would be a great time to do whatever
yeah.
you had in mind. Yeah.
Yeah, we can see how well it fits in. So
okay.
one of the things, we're actually kind of doing it already in just what we're talking about. which is I wanted to see somatically what it'd be like for you and I just to be and name our experience of what it's like to be with our differences, like actually tolerate, you know, sitting in these different spaces, because already I can feel like, oh, we're connecting, there's this way that there's a similarities, like, and that's that sameness, that sort of connecting that feels really great that we all love. It's the difference part that can be challenging, right? And so I'm wondering, like, thank you for being up for this. If you just, you know, we can just sit with, like, say around gender, or just start, you know, sex, like male, female, right? And just like noticing what it's like to just to name that, just our difference right there, different social, like the way we're socialized, the way we see the world differently, right? There's like the culture and just the, you know, sexism, power dynamics in our culture, like really feeling into that. What do you notice as you just kind of sit with me with this difference highlighted?
I notice that I want to make sure I'm giving you space, not talking over you, not being dominant in the conversation, not mansplaining anything. Those are the things that kind of come up when you're asking me about, like, oh, now that I'm noticing these differences.
Right.
And I want to be really careful around that.
Yeah. And somatically, when you try and feel like, just sense me, what do you notice just in the body versus how we were earlier? Like, now that I've named our difference.
Now I'm a little bit more tense, just like, oh, I better be cautious and on guard now, you know, a little bit more like aware that I have this, there's this power differential and I got to be careful with that.
And so just naming for me is like the when the identity of like being female or being a woman comes up, then suddenly there's a space between us. It's like, oh, right. You know, there's this, these roles in society, there's the history, you know, of our roles, and I can feel a bit of a distance, and that can, so there's a little discomfort, a little tension, and like, oh, I was liking our flow right before. And just this exercise can be great just to remember that this is okay, that sometimes we need to move into this space to allow the other person to share their difference, and we need to tolerate this distance and tension for a moment, so that then we can then come together knowing this difference.
Interesting. Right?
Like a lot of people like to jump to the sameness, like, oh, let's just, we're all one. We all love each other. We all believe, like, you know, equality and all these things and equity. But we go there too soon, then you bypass this.
Interesting.
This is what needs to happen sometimes, right? When you say, yeah, go ahead.
Well, what does this do for us? Like, why? I actually agree with you. I think there's a lot of ways. I used to train yoga teachers, and I worked in prisons and all kinds of rehab centers, and some really well-intentioned, highly resourced white women wanted to go in and work with African-American men, and they would use the lines like, we're all the same, we're all really, and I'm like, no, that's not going to go across really well. That's really ignoring the reality of what they're facing as black men in jail or in a rehab center. And so we had to work through that with our teachers to get them to understand the differences are actually extremely important to be with and name. So that's where I could come from with that. But why would we want to have a, like, even a little rupture, you know, of like that?
Right. Mention? Well, so the rupture, like, this was artificial. I just created an exercise, right? But if there was a time, or if there was a way in which the identities around our gender differences came up where I got upset about something, and if you were able to sit in the fact that you were a man and you were noticing, oh, right, maybe I was mansplaining, maybe I was doing something, maybe I was interrupting her, and being able to talk to me just like, oh, like, what was your experience like? Because I want to check where I am with you. Like, and I, you know, and there's a way when you step into that distance, then you allow me to just, to share my actual experience. And I know you're really listening. You're not trying to brush it away and go, oh, but we're all the same. Everything's great. You're actually allowing us to be different. And you're seeing my experience in this moment. Say I was saying something about, you know, being a woman, right? Or like, oh, you were talking over me, you know? And so the way I've seen it before, sometimes people just go, oh, no, I wasn't. You're just imagining, like, I wouldn't do that. I think what you're saying is really important. Let me tell you the way in which it's important, right? And they go into that place. But that space allows me to be seen, I think is what it is. And so like what you're saying, going into prisons and talking to people so different from you, it's like, you don't know what's going on for them. You don't know anything. I wouldn't know anything. I would just, you know, want to listen.
Mm-hmm. I think so. What I'm hearing is connecting across differences also means being tolerating discomfort of being different. Like there's a being comfortable in the discomfort of it. Like, okay, there is something here that doesn't feel right, but I can tolerate that for the sake of healing, growth, listening, whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, just, and maybe this is the work, you know, work you've done when working with clients. Like if I were a female client to you, or it could be a coworker, right? It doesn't have to be just in a therapeutic space. But if I came to you and said, and I was angry about men in general, I had a very bad experience at work or something happened, and I needed to get angry about men in front of you. I needed you as a man to see me with my struggles and not to join me in it, but to be a man witnessing and going, oh, yeah, I'm like, and feeling it with me. Sometimes we can be that for other people, and it's hard. Like, it's so hard to take that because there's a way it touches us too, because we're kind of that group, right? That they're angry with, and yet we need to be that. And it changes us when we really sit in it. It's really uncomfortable. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying, you know, if it's like intense, like anger and rage coming at you, like there's limits of what we can handle. But sometimes it is anger. Sometimes it is rage in the room, not at you, but in the room. That touches you and it hurts, and it's painful. And yet it can be very transformative.
So as we're wrapping up our show, could you just summarize really in a sentence or two, you know, the heart of your work and what you'd hope the listeners take from this show?
I think the biggest piece is it's so much around capacity of us just being able to tolerate being with each other's suffering. To really be in our hearts and to really just experience together being with the suffering of others, not to erase it, not to get rid of it, not to even totally join it, but just almost like we're witnessing and we're being with each other's suffering.
Thank you so much for coming on the show and just sharing a little about who you are and what you're doing in the world. I think it has immense value for the growth of our society and our cultures. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome. Take good care.
All right.
There you have it, folks. Angela Okawa, which I believe you can find at mindfuldiversity.com. Check her out and her work out as well. And I really appreciate you all listening today. Remember, we're kind of closing our show in a few weeks. So thank you all so much for listening this whole time. And just a reminder, this is your life to live. So dare to dream and live big and become who you're meant to be. From Radio Boise, this is Radio Awake.